The spring of 2020 is a real true doozy, full of angst about most things newsy, a pandemic, forced election and government gaffes, plus a mid-April snowstorm just for laughs. Welcome to Spectrum West, entertaining space for sheltering in place. I'm Al Ross, and as we continue our individualized existence, Wisconsin Public Radio is your consistent companion. We're making the most of a situation and hope you maintain the same ability with you and yours. The phrase we hear a lot right now is we're all in this together, and that's how we think about our partnership with you. We do a good job of supporting each other. Us with the information and entertainment you need and enjoy, and you with the funding to keep it going. During our spring membership drive, if you have support to spare, please call 888-202-2552 or go to WPR.org. Thanks, as always. This week on the show, poet Max Garland helps us continue our National Poetry Month observance. Catherine Thomas read about a strong Midwestern culture in the book Hmong in Wisconsin and talks with the author, Mai Zhang Vu. We'll stop in at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee to see how they're doing in the quiet of a long intermission. And we begin right here. Social distancing aside, you can't talk to a visual artist about a project without allowing the visual. So the other day, I trekked over to Menominee, carefully, to call on Michael Pila, a stained glass artist whose work is reflected in a nationwide reputation. He's working on a large piece to be installed in a window casing that's part of the western river-facing periphery of the Pablo Center in downtown Eau Claire. So while most people are feeling isolation and separation from coworkers, artists are keenly aware of what's going on. But distancing, at least during the 9-to-5, isn't a big departure because artists often work alone in their studios, accompanied by music or intelligent conversation like what's found on Wisconsin Public Radio every day. So, Michael, what's your personal and your professional perspective on the mess we're in?
Well, my professional perspective, it feels like, in many respects, the world has come to a halt. So I still get emails from people about projects I'm supposed to be working on. And then there are some projects that I'm supposed to be working on, and I can't get any answer at all about anything. So they've gone dark. I do work alone almost all the time now. So it doesn't really change this. We have a family member who's very high risk, so we understand how important it is to be aware of where you're at and what you're doing. And I take it seriously. It changes things a bit, but not too much.
As a bit of history, I've been in your studio before, and it's nice to be back. You spent quite a number of years working out of a studio in St. Paul prior to moving your operation to Menominee.
St. Paul was home and home, living in outskirts of St. Paul, working in St. Paul, in a building predominantly that was filled with artists. If you wanted people to visit, you left your door open. If you wanted to be left alone, you closed your door. I missed that interaction, but it kind of prepped me for the privacy aspect of when you're trying to get work done, usually you don't want to see anybody. But I miss those people. I miss the community. I'm in Menominee. There's a community here, but I'm not quite in that yet, but that's okay.
You've worked on some very high-profile projects, from new installations to restorations, cathedrals to Ronald McDonald houses, both places of devotion, just different kinds. And you've worked on many others. And as we speak, you're working on something special for the Pablo Center. Tell me what you're working on and how it all began.
Well, it began with knowing that the Pablo was underway. It was being designed. I saw things in the paper. I noticed that they had color on the exterior glass walls. I didn't know what that meant. It reminded me that maybe I should belong there, or at least a possibility. So I chased it with no luck initially. And then I met you, and you orchestrated a tour. The door got opened. Eventually, I was able to help orchestrate a donor, one of my patrons. That opened the door further. And we eventually moved from the atrium to another room, more of a presentation meeting room that's still on the same west wall, but is a keyed space. So it gets used a lot, but it's not for the general public. It became apparent that we needed to find a better location budget-wise, but yet still capture the light. My big opportunity there was the light.
This is sunset light.
Sunset light, or winter, kind of when the sun is low. It still overlooks the river, so you get the combination of sunlight and reflected light coming off the water. So you actually get a double projection, which really animates something in the way of stained glass.
I earlier in my notes referred to it as an installation. What do we call this? Is it sculpture? Is it an installation? And tell us what the theme is.
I think of it as just architectural art glass. It's part of the architecture, part of the building. It gets installed into the building. It's not something that's real movable. It becomes part of the structure. The theme of the building is the river. It is the confluence.
Sure.
And that was kind of an easy decision for everybody. And using my simple vocabulary of forms, which is often squares and circles, created something that, in my mind, tells the story of there being a river and how that brings things and people and community and progress together, makes things happen.
We're in the studio of stained glass artist Michael Pila. We visited Menominee on a snowy morning. So you brought up your donor. What did you call him?
Patron.
Patron. Jim Hansen is a big fan of yours.
Jim and I have been working together on either commissions for himself or for other customers, clients that he wants to help out for about 25 years. In the Pablo, there's the James Hansen Gallery. Same person. So there's a connection there.
When you're working on something big and important like this, although I should probably note that everything you do is important, are you able to concentrate on only this, or do you have to juggle your time between this and other things? Is it start to finish, or do you dabble and check in once in a while?
So once I get committed to a big project, it becomes the main driving force. When I get fed up with it or frustrated or tired or confused, all those things happen, I will take a break and go back to other projects that are smaller jobs that I'm also working on. So I'm a little ADD. I bounce around just a bit. But typically, bigger projects, and this is a bigger project, the window's about almost 3 by 9.5 feet, so it's pretty big. And it's all copper, which is quite unique and time-consuming. It takes up a lot of space, so you can't just let it sit there for a long time. You have to get it started, get it moving, keep it moving, get it done.
So that people can visualize what it is. You said 3.5 by 9 or something. That's a vertical piece?
That's a vertical piece. These are nice vertical windows in that room. It's a good spot.
So you talked about the lighting effect. Is the effect reflection, refraction? And how does one choreograph the desired result? Or is the art sometimes... I talk to potters every once in a while, and they tell me that when you put a piece in the kiln, it often comes out as a very pleasant surprise. Are you surprised often, or is it choreographed?
I am always trying to find out as much as I can about a particular opening and its light and the environments. When the light comes through, where's it going to go? What's it going to do? So I do my best to do a little experimentation with different types of materials, different types of glass. Mm-hmm. And then I have that in the back of my mind as I'm designing. I pick my materials. As I'm going through, I'm making a list. And then it happens in the sense that I typically get what I expect, but more often than not, I get more than I expect because I can't imagine everything. I can imagine what I have seen as opposed to imagining things I've not seen. So I think about reflecting light and how it changes the refraction of things. It's an animated light. Okay. And I think about certainly color and palette. And I'm more of a light person than a color person. Then the space, a space with white walls, with a neutral floor, with a lot of distance, because the experience of a window up close versus at a distance are quite different. So this has both an opportunity for up close, proximate viewing. Get right to it, almost touch it if you want, to about 35 feet away from it when you first enter the room.
Is it positioned in such a way that when the sun is at a certain point, that it's going to be something projected on a white wall, in a layman's way of saying it?
Well, it should project onto the window well and then possibly onto a wall also, because the window is in the corner. It's at the corner. So it's within a few feet of the corner, and it's long and tall. It has a chance to do an awful lot in there that I could only imagine. I didn't sit there every day of the year and watch. No, couldn't do that. So I was busy.
Would Michelangelo have done that?
I'm sure if they wanted him to, he would have. Or if he could, he would.
What is the ETA on this?
August 1st is the estimated. I was going to beat that. I was going for more like July 1st. But now I'm kind of a little bit on hold, making progress, but not quite as furiously as I was at first.
Because of what we're going through now?
Yeah, because of what we're going through, being aware that the Pablo itself, this affects them dramatically. So I can't expect for them to interact with me right now. So I'm just kind of doing the work, see what happens.
It's very interesting. Does this piece have a title?
Not yet. If they make me give it a name, I will. I typically never title something unless it's something I've made just for myself.
I have to congratulate you. You, like many artists, are able to leave behind so many legacies. Unlike a guy like me who, once he stops talking, it's over. You're going to leave your work through generations and generations. Do you think about that when you work on your stuff?
I do. Having restored a lot of windows, I'm aware that at some point in time, there comes a time when they need another artist, another craftsperson to work on them, to give them a new life. And that if something is valued and maybe inherently valuable, that goes on, and it can go on for a long, long time, centuries. I spent a couple months in England at Canterbury Cathedral one year working on medieval windows. Was a great lesson in what you make lasts, so do the best you can.
Do you in any way sign your stained glass? Is there a way that we can go, oh, there it is?
Well, for me, this particular technique, the copper clips on the joints, I'm the only person that does that. The technique is the signature. And because it's been published in enough different places, if someone wants to know, if they see something, they research it, they'll figure out it's me. I often get emails from people or phone calls from 20 years ago. I saw something. Did you do that? And usually it's my fault. Yes, I did that. So
I see beveled glass, too. Do you bevel it?
I'm not a beveler. I use a beveler, and I use off-the-shelf bevels. I think one of the things that is a hallmark of my work often is the unusual use of historic bevels in a non-traditional way. I'm using the bevels because of the light and what it does to the light. Also, I like the pure clarity of a beveled piece of glass in contrast to all of the other glass.
And he used to be a quarterback for the Badgers, Darryl Bevel.
I didn't know that, no.
Thanks for inviting me in. It's always fun to visit your studio.
Well, thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it.
Coming up, the art of the poet Max Garland, and the book spells out a journey that began nearly 50 years ago and continues today on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank. At this time of isolation, Charter Bank is investing in connection and offers online and mobile banking with staff available to assist. Charterbank.bank, connected with you in mind. Support also comes from Just Local Food in Eau Claire, community-owned and dedicated to providing locally sourced, organically grown whole foods. Information about membership is available at justlocalfood.coop, C-O-O-P. Well, while on the aforementioned trip to Menominee on Monday, I decided to swing over to visit our good friend Mabel Tainter. She's rather elderly, but looking nothing like her 131 years, and wanted to see how she's faring during this healthcare scare was a concern of mine. I met her caregiver, Executive Director Jeff McSweeney, shoveling April snow in the side parking lot. We went inside, sat in the first row of her elaborate but empty theater. Well, here we are, the spring of 2020. Kind of unforgettable. You're calling it an intermission.
Yeah, the intermission idea is just we're taking a rest, you know, along with the rest of America, cleaning the Mabel, doing some maintenance work, and shifting a whole bunch of groups, rescheduling them.
Using the word intermission, within that word is mission. Coincidence? I think not. You know, if you look at the prefix, intermission deals with open systems among groups. So, open systems among groups, which if you use a little creative license, you could say that intermission is an open system within which different groups, your audiences, experience your mission.
Wow. So much of the Mabel's mission is to serve Western Wisconsin public performances. We host a number of events throughout the year that aren't necessarily performances. We hosted the Board of Education Candidates Forum. We work with Stout on a lot of their things as well. That's a lot of our mission, is just being a community service.
You'll have to figure out a way to do something that's tantamount to the dimming of the lights to signify that intermission is over.
Oh, we're working on that. And moving forward, and what does this post-quarantine, this post-COVID-19 situation look like? And nobody knows. I'm not even setting dates yet, but we're working on the strategy of how does the Mabel serve the community coming out of this. And we're planning at this point at least to have a street party. So whenever we start rolling out, the community and government officials feel comfortable in larger public gatherings, we're going to be hosting a great music and outside activities until people feel comfortable coming back in the Mabel.
Tell us about the process that you had to use, and when did you decide it was time for you and the Mabel Tainter to fall into place? Because those decisions are tough. You had a lot of stuff going on, as did most people.
Yes, the Mabel Tainter is an independent entity. It's its own 501c3, so we weren't part of campuses that were shut down or government agencies that were shut down. We're independent. But, of course, we're going to follow what's best for the health and safety of our patrons. We were blessed to have Celtic Angels here on March 11th. Sold out house, standing room only, absolutely fabulous. And on that night, we had a couple of people that said, I'm not comfortable coming. I have challenges with my health. That's even kind of normal for any group. So even on March 11th, there wasn't big warning shots. And then come 4 days later, we were having another group come in on Saturday night, and the numbers weren't where we were expected. I talked with the group leader, and he said, what do you think's happening? Do you think this virus is starting to affect numbers? And we canceled that show in advance because of the diminishing numbers. And at that point, I think organically, like the rest of the world, we didn't know how bad it was going to be. But we worked with the group and said, we agree with you, this isn't right. And then after that, it just all started happening. And going forward, it's going to be equally responsible to come back up to speed. And talking with my board and the different committees, we could have the green light to open. The government has said, yes, it's possible, but will the people start coming back into closed spaces that quickly? So it's going to be a double measure.
We're sitting in the stunning theater at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Executive Director Jeff McSweeney is our guest. We're in his house, let's put it that way. Jeff, there are some positive consequences of this experience. I'm looking at things much more carefully because I simply have time to do that. But until this point, other than it being impressive, I've never really thought about all the history. The Tainter family had it rough. They lost Mabel at age 19. They lost a couple other children, I think. Here's the theater, a memorial building whose very foundation is built on never forgetting. And think about all the trials and tribulations that this building has endured in 131 years since 1889. Here we are again in a situation that we're never going to forget. This is where a place like the Mabel shines as a beacon of been there, done that. I mean, just looking at the building and thinking about her should remind us that we indeed can do this.
Absolutely. It was led by Henry Doty Maxon, Minister Henry Doty Maxon, a Unitarian minister, that encouraged the Tainters to build this in Mabel's honor. Some people think this is a church. It was never a church, but it did have church services in it through the 1980s. Yeah. But the building was built for public discourse. We had the library in here for a number of decades, and the idea of speeches and performances were really a core of why the building was built. And we're here as a beacon to the community, beacon to the region, actually. People coming together, enjoying each other's company, having a shared experience, learning something, laughing, crying, and moving forward.
Outside of the Tainter's doors, think of all the things that have happened in those 131 years. World wars, other conflicts, natural disasters. And here it is, still standing. People in Menominee should use it as an inspiration, and good for you guys.
Thank you so much. I was doing some research on the Spanish flu, And they had newspaper articles where buildings were shut down during that time. That was in the 19-teens,
yeah.
You know, the Great Depression. The advent of motion pictures that came through, and it was almost the end of this beautiful building. And people reimagined themselves, reimagined what they can do, and moved forward. And that's what I think is going to happen here after we get through COVID-19, is that we're going to reimagine ourselves, offer something better, and move forward.
And let's imagine those good times. You have, like everybody else, adjusted. Tell us about beer chats. You just had the second. Are there going to be more?
Yes, and I'm looking for content like everybody okay. else is. When we first started this, again, is we're all trying to evaluate what's possible. We were going to be posting groups on stage and videotaping them. A week later, everybody was doing that from their basement or their home, and we had some great folks from Broadway that opened up their shows and allowing those to be viewed free of charge. And that kind of put us on a back burner as far as what we were going to offer. Mm-hmm. So in working with my board and the community again, we came across Mabel's Fables, where individuals can read their favorite stories, do the blessings of Zoom, which I think most people are familiar with now that they didn't hear of a month ago. Oh, we can have an international beer chat. So one of the board members had a friend in Germany, an expert on German beer, had visited the Mabel and said, let's tie this in. So we're looking for a number of opportunities that are very Mabel-specific, maintaining our leadership in economic development, cultural development, and socialization.
Zoom and PPE, they're now part of our vernacular.
Correct. And with Zoom, I mean, we're still maintaining all of our board meetings, our committee meetings, making sure that we're doing what we need to do during these trying times, and, of course, moving forward, which I'm really thrilled with the leadership of the folks involved with this wonderful, wonderful building.
Theater events, some have been postponed. Tell us about the biggies and when they are planned to happen.
We are thrilled with the agents and the performers that we've worked with. As you may be aware, in your profession, there's a clause called force majeure. No matter what, you owe us money. That is a death knell for facilities like ours. And down to every performer, they have cooperated with us. They understand the extenuating circumstances. And, of course, they want to maintain a good public relations aspect going forward. So when all this hit and they weren't going to travel, we weren't going to force, they weren't going to enforce, but we rescheduled. And we're really fortunate that we've got the amazing Kreskin coming back on August 8th. With any luck, we're going to have the Menominee Theater Guild coming in for their summer camp in July. That's another one that we're very, very hopeful for. If you look earlier, sorry, I'm not going in order. I'm still optimistic we'll still have stuff at the end of May. I haven't yet delayed that. I have a lot of people laughing at me. You can't be serious that you think that's going to happen, but they're still on the calendar.
I was going to bring those up. You do have May events leading into the summer. Since you brought that up, what's your process of determining viability?
So we look at a number of patrons that have signed up and the comfort of them as well as the artist. So much with the Mabel Tainer are people that were on a route. Tish Hinosa, who is really the next major ticketed event that we have on Friday, May 22nd, we have to see what's going to happen with the governors, if they're going to be coming out of quarantine after April 30th, and if not, then we start reaching out to Tish. She'll look around and say, has she got her route? If she does, we'll stay on that route. If the route's falling apart and all the theaters are canceling or postponing, then that's what we'll do with her. And that's been with everybody that we've worked with. It's mostly that they're on a route. The Mabel seating only 261. We don't have enough gross income to offer anybody to fly in from New York, perform, and fly back. Now, I've seen some, like with Garrison Keillor, when we're having a really large show, or possibly Louis Anderson, that we can seat upwards of 300. Now, those aren't seats, when I share that with folks and say these might be a limited sight line or not the most comfortable, it's their decision whether they come or not. But the 261 is comfortable, good sight lines to the stage. And then following the amazing Kreskin on August 8th, we've got Davina and the Vagabonds coming on August 16th. Judy Collins, happily rescheduled for August 23rd. And then Rodney Crowell, who is our other big, big show that we had here in the spring, due to his scheduling, we've got him coming back on October 22nd. Mm-hmm. And fingers crossed, Al, all this will happen without a hitch.
And it'll all happen after your what? Your street dance?
I'm one of those that has to engage. I've worked with a number of other CEOs and executive directors for nonprofits in the community in planning a street party, a celebration of making things happen again, getting folks in a common space. We're going to put the stage out in the parking lot, have a dance party, have the other nonprofits come in and just promote what they do, have tours of the Mabel, get people back out and seeing each other again.
The Mabel Tainter website is the best place to get the latest info?
Absolutely. So it's MabelTainter.org, and then Facebook with our videos and such, and email newsletter that you can sign up for and get all the current activities and plans for the future.
Jeff McSweeney, thank you.
Thank you, Al. Pleasure having you in our beautiful theater.
So there you go. That's about half of a conversation with Jeff McSweeney, executive director at the Mabel Tainter. I understand we had some technical difficulties, and I'm sorry that you missed the conversation with Michael Pila, the stained glass artist, our other stop in Menominee. But remember, this is barring any preemption tomorrow night, Friday night. You can hear the show in its entirety on the News and Classical Music Network, 89.7 and 90.7 in western Wisconsin. So all is not lost, I hope. A poem for this age of ours from Max Garland coming up, and Catherine Thomas stops by next. After a quick reminder that now during our spring membership drive, we have the opportunity to do even more good during challenging times by supporting the source of much of the information you've needed and received. Wisconsin Public Radio depends on listener, that's you, support, what we need. You are our largest funding resource. Please do what you can. Make a donation by phone at 888-202-2552 or online at WPR.org. And thank you. Catherine Thomas, always in search of a new experience, did not really know a whole lot about the proud Hmong culture quotient that's part of Wisconsin's human equation. So, she read a book.
So the Hmong people, they have a long history before they came to Wisconsin as political refugees in the 1970s. 8,000 miles. What was it like for you and your family to travel so far to a place you had never been before?
Well, for me as a teenager, I did not really feel the pain that my parents are feeling. I was more optimistic, looking for new opportunities. You know, as my brother-in-law said, when the plane took off in Bangkok and it circled and it went over Laos and headed to the U.S., tears and emotions just, you know, all rush out. And, oh, my God, this is the last time I will ever see my country again. And I'm going to a place where it's unknown. I don't know what's going to happen. So there's a lot of emotions, fear of the unknown. What is this, you know, new place that we're going is going to be like? Will the people like us? Will they, you know, so all of these are bottling up together.
What other challenges were there to living in a new place? Some sponsors would give blocks of cheddar cheese, and the Hmong families didn't eat cheddar cheese, so they would politely hide them.
Yep. I think the very first thing that is clashing is the food, right? The aroma of the food that you're not used to, and cheese, you know, is a good example of that because we don't do dairy in Asia, and so... You know, when our sponsor brought in these beautiful cheddar cheese bar, we opened it, covered our nose, and then quickly put it in a bag and threw it in the kitchen cabin. And then the next week, they came and they thought that we liked it so much, and then they bought more. And pretty soon, we have a whole kitchen full of cheddar cheese where one day, you know, she opened up the kitchen cabin and found her beautiful cheese. And I always joke that if I knew how expensive cheese is, you know, we would have gotten a lot of beautiful jasmine rice.
So food
is an adjustment. The weather is another one because, you know, many people always ask me, how come you guys come to such a cold state? And I always say, well, we are at the mercy of our sponsor. Whoever sponsors us, we go there. We don't know where we're going. Unlike the immigrants who plan where they're going and they know who's waiting for them on the other end. We don't, and we don't know where we're going. We don't know that the North of America is colder than South, so we don't know about these things. We just come. So the weather is quite an adjustment as well. When we first came, we thought American people have warm blood because, you know, in dead winter, we still walk outside nice and, you know, happy. But until later, we found out that there's such thing as, you know, undergarments where people layer up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talked about sponsors, and that has something to do with why Hmong people came to Wisconsin.
The refugee resettlement plan for Southeast Asian in the United States is to scatter them throughout the United States so they would adjust into mainstream faster. Of course, that plan did not work out because we are a close-knit community. We have clan system and so forth. Once churches, you know, agree that they would resettle refugees, they would bring them to their church, wherever it is. So here in Wisconsin, it would be like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, and so forth. Then they would say, yeah, we have so-and-so, and so-and-so will sponsor, or our church will sponsor so-and-so. So then the family come, then they find basic housing, basic jobs, and teach them the basic things like, you know, how do you turn on a stove? How do you go to work? How do you get a job? And so that very first resettlement in the 80s for Hmong is pretty much church sponsors. And then, of course, after that is a lot of family reunification as well.
Mai Zhongvu talks with us today about her new book, Hmong in Wisconsin. It's one of the most recent additions to the Wisconsin Historical Society's series, People of Wisconsin. So throughout your book, Mai Zhong, you make note of generational differences, and you even name your generation the 1.5 generation.
Mm-hmm.
How have different generations of Hmong people responded and contributed to life in Wisconsin?
Every generation is responding and acculturating differently. Our parents, they are responding differently from, you know, whether they're mom or dad. And then from children like us who came as teenager, we are responding differently. And then, of course, the firstborn generation here is different. So for our parents, you know, depending on individual clan and family, for example, in my family, my dad, I'm old, I can't learn another language, I would just help my community as much as I can, so therefore I'm not going to bother learning another language. My mom, on the other hand, I may be old, but I need to learn because my kids need to go to school, my kids need to go and find a job, I need to make friends so I can navigate the system. She would sit on a bus in Kokona and ride the bus to Appleton just so she could make conversation with a Caucasian. Or she would go to the thrift store, the clerks will come and say, how can I help you, right? And then she'll have a conversation. By the time I finished high school and went on to college, she's able to take a message from me and say, oh, your friend so-and-so call and here's the phone number. So that two different perspectives. Or years later when my dad met Governor Thompson at the time, because my brother was Badger State Senator and he was at the reception, but he couldn't say anything other than a handshake. You know, at home, I asked my dad, how do you feel meeting the governor? And he said, I had a whole stomach full of words, but they wouldn't come out, you know. Mm-hmm. So the parents' generation is a lot of just making whatever they can and invest for their children's education. Some people, you know, work two jobs. Some people still do farming, you know, to earn extra income for their kids. People like us, the 1.5 generation, we are that kind of buffer between our parents and the mainstream because we learn the language first. We become the interpreter. We become the navigator. We become the advocates. Many of us, one thing that we agree is that failure is not an option for us, whether in surviving or in school. Whatever we do, we have to do well in order to build a path for the younger generation.
You give a lot of examples in your book of success and the measures that some people took, like your mom riding the bus and to make conversation, and the story about the person who wanted to get to know their neighborhood better so they would walk through the snow and then follow their tracks
mm-hmm.
back. I love those stories.
Yeah.
But you also talk about a turning point. I thought there was some anxiety in your writing about the future of Hmong traditions and culture in the U.S., and you write
mm-hmm.
that it's up to the youngest generation of Hmong in Wisconsin who are nearing a turning point in Hmong history. What is the turning point you're talking about?
When we come as refugees, we have been in a honeymoon stage. up until the first generation is born, we are still in that honeymoon stage. But, you know, now that we are here, people like myself raising my own kids, my kids, they no longer have the history that I have or the experience I have or my parents have, and they are Hmong in terms of background, but they're very Americanized, Wisconsinite by environment and by citizenship. And they don't have that background. They don't have that knowledge. They don't have the language and the culture aspect of it. And so that turning point is really about how do we help immigrants that come to this country, the first and second generation does really well, and then the third generation is kind of lost because they don't have that connection into their own identity. And I worry that our community is no different unless we make an intentional decision to make sure that our turning point does not repeat itself like other people. And that's where I'm referring to, because we have children right now who are in public school who are not doing well, but because we are the nice Asian kids, we have a double-edged sword where we are quiet, we don't cause trouble, so therefore nobody pays attention to us, but substantively we're not doing well academically. So I worry about the future of our kids, those who still don't have the structure and don't have the support system. This is what I'm referring to. In my family, you know, my kids are raised to be Hmong, but then we also raise them to be aggressive in school as well. And so sometimes kids have so much to balance on top of their own identity. I worry about that. And that's what I'm talking about, the turning point for our children. If they don't make it, then that means they're going to be a liability to our society.
I would like to say before we let you go that what I appreciate most about your book, besides the chance to learn more about Hmong history and culture, is the reminder of the courage and the resilience that it takes to start over in a new place. And you've helped deepen my respect for everybody who does that, past and in the present. I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. You know, I always have so much to say. I look forward to have more conversation when COVID-19 is over and we all can sit in a room and just dialogue.
Mai Zhongvu is the author of Hmong in Wisconsin. The book includes history, interviews, personal stories, and quite a few pictures. It's available through the Wisconsin Historical Society and in bookstores. Mai Zhongvu, thank you for this book and for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, as usual, Catherine. We appreciate it. Good to have you on the show. Once again, you may have missed the first 20 minutes or so of this week's show due to some sort of technical glitch, but good Lord willing, creek don't rise, and something official doesn't preempt us, we will have a repeat of the show tomorrow night, Friday night, 7 o'clock, on stations of the News and Classical Music Network. They are 89.7 and 90.7. of that network. So 7 o'clock Friday night, Michael Pila and the first part of Jeff McSweeney's chat. So there you go. Support for WPR comes from Dragonetti's Ristorante in Eau Claire for more than 50 years. Open Tuesday through Saturday from 4 to 8 for takeout or delivery. More information is on Facebook and at dragonettis.com. As you may already know, it is National Poetry Month, and you can be excused for not knowing or forgetting, given all there is to think about, but it's right up our alley, so we're celebrating by featuring some of our best resident poets. And this week, it's Max Garland, former state poet laureate and UW Eau Claire educator. You have the unique experience of having traveled the state during your tenure as poet laureate, meeting people where they live and thrive in their libraries and other venues that matter to them. First, given the times that we're in, how often Do you think about that experience? Because you can visualize the places that are now quiet without activity. And secondly, how did being poet laureate change your perspective on things, if at all?
I think about those travels, those miles across the state a lot, all the time, because I met people I'm still in contact with. I also think about the libraries a lot because many of them are probably closed or at least partially closed right now. And often in small towns, libraries are almost the only public space left that you can gather in, particularly without paying money. And so in some small towns, that's really important. And I wonder about that because it's such a source of community.
Gathering place.
Right, right. And, you know, that's where the books are. And poetry, you know, with the falling away of most small bookstores, literary bookstores, many bookstores of any sort, that's where you can still find poetry, books of poetry as well. Obviously, you can find it through the internet a lot, but... Yeah. I spent a lot of hours looking through books of poetry in our libraries.
I was thinking about shelter in place, the term, over the weekend. I don't think I ever thought that I would have to live sheltering in place, but here I am.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. A lot of writers I've talked to recently say, oh, sheltering in place, isn't that what writers do anyway?
Yeah. Artists,
and,
too,
and
yeah.
Yeah. And so in a way it is, but when you're really called upon to do it, you realize how much the trip to the coffee shop for 45 minutes really meant to you. And here in National Poetry Month, all sorts of poetry events and gatherings have been canceled. And even though they accounted for just a small part of your time, they meant a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Poetry... it's often a solitary art form in many ways, but you do have to get out there and breathe it into the air in front of actual human beings to keep it real.
Sure. I need endorsement from you before I believe this, but it seems to me that times like what we're withstanding today, a worldwide pandemic, pretty big deal, is exactly the kind of thing that gets writers and poets going. I mean... I envision this for you, like standing at the plate and knowing what kind of a pitch is coming. Does this open up the floodgates for writers?
That's an interesting way to put it. I have written some things from the very beginning of this period, this dilemma, this crisis about it. I'm not quite sure. It would seem that's true, but... we're always in some way at the mercy of mortality. I mean, that's kind of a given for writers, musicians. And so whether it's a worldwide consciousness of it or whether it's individual in your family or friends, I mean, I think that's always, maybe this is just a magnification of what writers always were thinking about was, you know, our time here is brief. We never know. It's not really guaranteed.
Sure.
And the fleeting nature of it is something that maybe on the larger scale we're being reminded of now, but it's there all the time.
Yeah. Max Garland, Emeritus Professor, UW Eau Claire, former Wisconsin Poet Laureate, getting his perspective on things as they are. We'll get to a verse in a moment. But John Prine's passing last week had some significance for you. Over and above his wordsmithing ability, you're also a musician, and you were both members of a different fraternity at one time. Tell me about the varied aspects of your admiration for Mr. Prine.
Well, for anyone who had literary or poetic aspirations or inclinations of my generation, Prine was an inspiration and a model. Now, when you mention the word fraternity, I just want to qualify that. We were both mailmen.
Yes.
And that's the thing we had in common. And he wrote some of his early great songs while delivering mail in the outskirts of Chicago. And I wrote about a third of my first book of poems while delivering mail in Western Kentucky. His parents were also born in Western Kentucky, not too far from where I grew up. And lived for a long, long time. He said well, you know, you've got a lot of time. You don't really have to think that much about what you're doing delivering mail. And I delivered mail on the route where I was born and the route that I lived on and my grandparents lived on. And so I could do it with my mind elsewhere, although I'm quite sure that some of the people who lived on that route got a certain amount of the wrong mail as a result of where my mind was. I used to pass by Muhlenberg County, the site of one of his early great songs, Paradise, and I used to see what he called the world's largest shovel looming above the tree line there at the Peabody coal mines. And so ever since that first album of his back in the early 70s, he's been a part of my consciousness. And for people of my generation, particularly people like Bob Dylan and John Prine, Joni Mitchell, were sort of gateways into the world of poetry, particularly for those of us who didn't have poetic upbringings. When we finally discovered poetry, we had already been acquainted with poetic music and songwriters who were like Prine, who smuggled poetry into what seemed like, you know, simple four-chord songs, you know, and yet there was brilliance and audacity in those songs, and it reminded me, or maybe it's the first time I discovered or realized that most poetry is not lined up in little books, university press books or Norton anthologies. A lot of poetry is floating out there in beautiful language in novels or hymns or sermons or songs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think that his songwriting helped unleash the possibilities of poetry and helped me feel like, oh, that's poetry. That's something that moves me. I understand it.
Well, do us a favor and share something that is the result of the thought and the perspective that you've had that we talked about earlier in our conversation during the times we're in. Would you please?
Sure. A poem I wrote a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago, called Social Distancing, which is what you and I are doing right now.
We are.
Say there came a pandemic. Some news-drunk virus set its hooks in us. And only the sky for a nurse, arced and empty, barely even blue. And only the musical pulse and the several senses for consolation, except for a stream of distant words like waves bearing the rush, curl, and foam of elsewhere arriving. The distant rhythm of others to bridge the gap between head and heart, dark and day, fear and whatever it is one feels on the brink of when walking next to great waters. How the surf catches and releases the light, and the waves and bones tremble like the distant cousins of constant thunder. We know salt tumbles eventually from ocean to body and back and forth. We know it takes ages to regather the shaken self into the good world again. I remember a ritual once where hundreds of tiny basket-like boats were lit and launched with prayers and flowers and misfortunes, ignited and cast out on the water until the bay was ablaze, a rocking constellation of human woe uttered in small tongues of flame. Until, little by little, they drifted, burned, blinked out, and then it was just dark water again, and we all went home. Did our troubles never return? Were we really less burdened or better people? What I mean is, sometimes worry needs to be ignited, launched into words. If only to blaze a while among flotillas of sorrows we thought were ours alone. What I really mean, of course, is keep in touch, even if you don't know what to say, especially if you don't know what to say. Kind words, fellow castaways, mind-lit emergencies of fingertip, and tongue. Float this festival of downtime and distance. Repopulate the dark with your fledgling human light.
I think there's going to be some good come out of this. I think people are going to be much more reflective. And I hope they've been taking the time to be reflective through their solitude. Solitude has always been a positive word. It's supposed to be a positive word as opposed to loneliness. We should relish,
right, exactly.
Relish solitude.
And the art of sculpting solitude so that it doesn't become loneliness, that's the effort required now.
You know, I think our perspective should be that everyone in the world is going through the same thing.
Right. And
that brings a whole big wide umbrella to sit under.
I think that's true. I think that in the poem Social Distancing, there's a part in which those little boats that were launched in a ritual, when you saw them all out there together, you realized, oh, look, your sorrow is out there with all of the other sorrows. And one of my favorite writers, James Baldwin, pointed this out, you know, in many places, but he talked about how it was books, it was literature, really, that taught him that the thing that hurt him most was the thing that united him with everyone who ever lived. In other words, it wasn't until he realized that his suffering was what he had in common with other people that he fully understood what literature was about.
Max Garland, I wish for you a return to the coffee shop sooner rather than later.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Happy social distancing.
Is there such a thing?
Maybe not. Maybe that's a relative wish.
Hey, again, for those of you, and that's all of you, who missed the first 20 or so minutes of this week's program due to a mechanical, technical snafu, again, you can catch the show in its entirety tomorrow evening, Friday evening, 7 o'clock, on stations of the News and Classical Music Network. Glass artist Michael Pila gave us a very nice conversation, then we traveled down the street in Menominee to the Mabel Tainter to see how their intermission was going. So if you have time, check it out tomorrow at 7 on 89.7 and 90.7 in West Wisconsin. I'll keep my fingers crossed that nothing COVID-related keeps that reprise from happening. So thank you for that. And thanks for your support during our spring membership drive. Remember, the number is 888-202-2552, and WPR.org is where to go on the website. Hey, of course, COVID has caused cancellations. The Fiddle School up in West Denmark, scheduled for June, that's been canceled. But the people involved, Harold Hoggart and Christian Buga, are going to give you some concerts. Harold, Saturday, 2 o'clock. Christian, Sunday, 2 p.m. This is online. This is on Facebook, everybody. The Wayward Players, Heidi Center for the Arts, and Iconostar Productions have posted the 2017 production Snowbirds on YouTube. So just look for Jerry Way's Snowbirds. Thanks for being in the audience. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live safe. Be smart. See you next week, everybody.